Hello, and welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus, the podcast about people teaching and learning at Gustavus Adolphus College, and the myriad ways that Gustavus liberal arts education provides a lasting foundation for lives of fulfillment and purpose. I'm your host, Greg Castor, faculty member in the Department of History. Quote, as a Muslim American woman of Egyptian descent, education is a privilege I do not take for granted. So observed my guest today, Dr. Hagar Atiyah of the Gustavus Communication Studies Department, while a grad student in communication at California State University, Fresno, where she was a graduate Dean's Medal nominee in 2010. She recently earned her PhD in communication from the University of Maryland, College Park, where she won her department's Outstanding Teaching Award, and is now in her second year as a Gustavus faculty member, having begun in fall 2021. Her courses thus far at Gustavus have focused on public deliberation and dialogue, rhetorical criticism, and public discourse. Along with teaching, Dr. Atiyah is active in her discipline, including most recently as a presenter at the 2022 Rhetoric Society of America Conference in Baltimore. She's also engaged in public scholarship and is currently involved in voter engagement efforts on our Gustavus campus. Her department and mine share the third floor of wonderful Beck Hall, and our occasional brief chats, sort of water cooler conversations, have left me wanting to hear more about both her and her work, which is why I'm delighted she could join me for this more leisurely conversation. So welcome, Professor Atiyah. Hagar, it's great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. And it's funny, listeners, those of you who are familiar with Beck Hall, so Hagar, you're in your office. I don't know how many doors down from mine. I'm in mine.
Just down the hall.
I keep thinking of, you know, at least when I was a kid, you'd hook up strings to orange juice cans or something, and you'd pretend you're one of the, I don't even know if it worked, but anyway.
That's definitely what we're doing now, yeah.
All right. So, yeah, so great to have you on the podcast. Thanks so much. I really do mean I'd like to learn more about you. Just a little I've learned preparing for the podcast is interesting to me. As I do with a lot of, really almost all the colleagues we podcast with, I'd like to talk a little bit about teaching amid the pandemic, partly for the record. And I know you were doing that. The pandemic has not ended. Let's stipulate that. So we're all still teaching amid the pandemic. But before you started at Gustavus, you started the semester we kind of came back in person, fall 2021. Tell us a little bit about your online teaching experiences amid the pandemic. And especially, I'm thinking, you know, comm studies, communication. You know, you'd think it'd be so great to be in person, but no, I don't. What was that like?
It was definitely a challenge. So the pandemic sort of began while I was still at the University of Maryland. And at the time I was teaching the introductory communication course, COM 107, Principles of Public Speaking. And as you can imagine, that class really depends on being in the room and doing the communication and presenting in front of an audience. And it's a very much practice-based course. And then we shifted online.
so weird. Difficult, yeah.
Yeah.
What did you do? I mean, how did you adjust if you did?
Yeah, we took, 2 weeks to figure out how to teach online and do Zoom, and took a bunch of, workshops and try to figure out. But at the end of the day, we had people, you know, do our activities and do them in breakout rooms and present speeches on Zoom, and modify our instructions and our assignments so that, you know, so we usually have expectations for eye contact with the audience. But if your audience isn't in the room, how do you do eye contact? So we talk about looking at the camera and, you know, modifying your slides so that they work in a online setting. And so it was, I think that it made our teaching better. We work many presentations now, and I anticipate in the future are going to happen online. And so preparing for that reality was I think, a fruitful experience.
Yeah, that's... Learn, but I agree with you. I think, God knows none of us want this pandemic, and we hope there will be more undoubtedly. But anyway, there's been some positive stuff. For example, I learned how to do a lot of things technologically I never had done before. Mm-hmm. And I think, yeah, and some of the things that I did, sounds like you're in the same position, you know, that I did online, I'm still doing. So Moodle forum posting, that kind of thing. What is it called? Asynchronous. Yes. Two words I thought I got, if I ever heard those again, synchronous and asynchronous, I've said before on the podcast. But yeah, it was a challenge. But it sounds like you had the time to get ready too. We were lucky it could save us too. I think we had 2 weeks also, thank God. Mm-hmm. I know some schools had, faculty had to scramble like almost overnight. Yeah. How many students were you teaching in that class? You may have said, but how many? Is it like 20 or more?
It's about 20. It's a small group class. It's capped actually at 19.
Okay.
And again, because of that like high interaction, the right. small class size works for it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's good. It's useful for the students too, I think, to learn about us as well, but you know, how to make eye contact. Where do you look if you're online and being interviewed, let's say, which is more and more the case, it seems to mm-hmm. me, right? Even apart from the pandemic.
Yeah. I was interviewed online for this position.
Oh, yes. I'm taking the words out of my mouth. I was just going to say several people we've hired. Exactly. Yeah. I better not say, but yes, looking online, looking at the people who are interviewing you, even though you can't see them, does make a difference. Let's mm-hmm. just leave it at that, I would say. Here we are. We're back in person, thank goodness, and hopefully it stays that way without us all getting sick. Yeah. But tell us, so, you know, I didn't know about your background, that you're of Egyptian descent. And I don't know if you remember that quote. I dug up that quote. I found it somewhere.
Oh, it's an old quote. I can't remember what it was for. I think it was for award ceremony.
I think it was you were this graduate Dean's Medal nominee, and I think you had to make a statement in 2010. Yeah, it was really a neat statement.
Lifetime ago,
right. Now you're a doctor, you're a professor. But I love that quote. I found it interesting. And so mm-hmm. tell us a little bit about where you grew up and your background.
Yeah. So I was born and raised in, it used to be a small town, but it's not so small anymore, Fresno, California. Yeah. And my parents are both Egyptian immigrants to the United States.
Do they come from Cairo or where did they come from?
No, my dad is from Pampa, which is like north of Cairo in the Delta region. It's more rural. Uh-huh. And my mother is from Cairo.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you know how they met? I'm just curious.
Yes. Funny story. They were set up by friends. My dad was like back in Egypt. He had come to the United States in the 80s and he went back to Egypt, with the intention of finding a nice girl to marry. And he met a friend on a bus of all places. And he told him, you know, I'm looking to meet a nice girl. And he's like, I've got the person for you. My wife's best friend. And that's how they met.
Oh, that's great. That's a good story. Yeah. So your dad came first, he's here first, and then did your mom come right away after their marriage, or?
It was a little bit afterwards, like maybe 6 months after they were married. She had followed him, you know, because of like immigration procedures and things like
right.
that. Right. Yeah.
Are they academics, or what were they doing? What do they do?
My dad was studying engineering, but he doesn't do that anymore. He is a business owner. He works, his business is to provide halal meat to different.
Oh, wow. No kidding.
Yeah. So he's a meat broker, halal meat broker.
Oh, for, man.
Like, stores in California.
Love to get to know him. Okay. Oh, that's cool. That's interesting. Wow. Yeah. I love learning about people's jobs. Like, who knew there's a meat broker? Okay. That's so cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then that's his own business, it sounds like?
That's his own business. He works with a company called Harris Ranch. It's like the largest beef producer on the West Coast. And he basically runs their halal division.
That is amazing. That's huge. I mean, it goes all over the all. Does it go all over the world, you know, or just this country?
It's really focused on the West Coast. Yeah.
On the West Coast. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and what about your mom? Is she still working?
My mom in Egypt, she studied biochemistry. And then when she came to the United States, she focused on raising a family. I'm one of six kids.
Oh boy. Big
so
family.
She had her hands full with us, and she volunteers, you know, in our masjid and our mosque. And
okay.
So that's how that's their experience. Yeah.
Wow. So does she have a doctorate in biochemistry, or that was her kind of undergraduate?
She had pursued some graduate work, but, you know, felt like her calling was elsewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Boy, that's really interesting. So I don't know if I've ever been to Fresno. I certainly love California. My brother lives in Los Angeles. What is there a sizable Egyptian population, Egyptian American population there?
Yeah, we have, you know, a few families that we're friends with. It's a really diverse area in California. So there's not just Egyptian, there's also like a sizable Yemeni population. Okay. And a sizable Persian population, in terms of like, you know, like the Muslim population, as well as like a South Asian community.
Incredible diversity.
Yeah.
I know. It's just that when I, and there's incredible diversity even in this state. People don't realize that sometimes, but I do recall when I first came from, my wife and I, Kate, who used to teach in the history department, we came from Boston to Minnesota, and then it would be going back to Boston or New York or Chicago or Los Angeles to visit my brother. And just the airports, it's like, oh my God, this is so different. Or the first time I went to Memphis, and you know, it was just you could do a whole course on ethnicity and immigration, just looking at airports, right? I mean, it's so amazing. So are you one of, so you have brothers and sisters among the other five?
Yeah. I have four sisters and one brother.
Okay. Are you the only academic, only prof, or there's some?
So far. I'm the first.
Yeah, that's great. That's cool. Me too. Let me ask about growing up. So did you, my dad was, maybe I've told you, my dad was Greek American. His parents had come from Greece. And my cousins went to Greek school, at least some of them, and could speak Greek. My brother and I grew up in, you know, the suburbs of Chicago, and my dad spoke Greek, but, you know, we only spoke bad words, basically, my brother and dad. But I wish I had spoken Greek. This is a long way of asking, did you grow up speaking, I guess it would be Arabic, right, or not?
I did, yeah. Arabic was actually my first language.
Wow.
And I made the mistake on, like, in high school when they asked about our, like, ESL, try to determine our ESL status, of saying that Arabic was my first language. And so every year, even though, like, you know, I grew up speaking English as well, but every year I was evaluated for my English for that reason, because Arabic was my first language. And we went to Saturday schools to learn Arabic and memorize the Quran. And
I'm envious. I guess it's not too late, but I wish I'd grown up speaking Greek. And I guess can you read it as well? Are you able to?
Yeah. I mean, my Arabic is not as, it comes and goes. I have studied it like formally. I did like an intensive Arabic program about 10 years ago now in Egypt. And so I was doing pretty well at the time, reading and writing and speaking, even like the classical, like Fusha Arabic. But, you know, 10 years on, it's gotten a bit rusty.
I don't know. I mean, are there other, this shows you how naive I am, or are there other Arabic speakers on our campus? I have no idea.
That's a good question. Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure. I've been kind of sort of huddled in my office for the time that I've been here.
You were finishing your dissertation. It's your first year here. Yeah, makes perfect sense. Yeah, exactly.
I'd be happy to connect with other Arabic speakers on campus.
There is, there was, maybe people have told you, some people, there was a woman, a professor in math, Samia Ibrahim from Egypt.
I saw her
daughter. And she may still be in town. Yeah, I know. I ran into her daughter at a kind of a memorial for, I think it was her daughter, for a classics professor. Anyway, I just think it's cool. I mean, it's great. I just think being able to speak, you know, two languages is, to me, wonderful. So you're not the first to go to college, obviously, but what are you already interested in? Communication? Is there such a thing in high school where you're going? I remember having one high school student that was kind of media studies. That's what I think it was called. But how did you develop this interest in communication?
Yeah, it was communication studies wasn't something that I even knew about growing up. I knew that I wanted to be a teacher growing up. I loved my elementary school teachers. And then as I got into like middle school and high school, I became more interested in politics and current events. And so like in my college essays, I would talk about, this was like in 2003, 2004. So like the Iraq War was happening. So a lot of my focus and attention was like, what was going on there? And like the status of Muslims in America. And that was really on my mind at the time. And so I had originally thought I was going to do like political science when I went to college. So I entered college undeclared, wasn't really sure what I wanted to do, was leaning towards political science. And then I took like a sociology course, which I really loved because I felt like it covered everything. It was politics, but also, you know, economics and, you know, society in general. And so in the semester that I was like, had to declare a major, it wasn't my my second year as a sophomore, I was taking that sociology class, loved it. And I was also taking a communication class, like the standard general education requirement. It was Persuasion with Dr. Rich Ullman. I'll never forget him. I didn't think I was all that like good at it, but he really encouraged me to be a comm major because I was like undeclared at the time. I was like, I don't know, I think I'm going to do sociology. And he's like, no, you're really good at this. You should do it. Don't you want to do law school? You should do communication. It's going to help you. And just to like appease him, I minored in communication. I was like, I can't do the major, but I'll minor in it.
If your major was sociology, right? Is that right? Yeah. And this, I don't think I said in my intro, it's at Fresno, right? Fresno too, or not? Am I?
Yeah. CSU Fresno.
To appease this prof, you minor. Well, that's one way to get minors. By the way, I could not agree with you more about the one sociology course I took as an undergraduate. I just absolutely loved. And I'm dating myself here, but this was when it was really cool to be reading. This is in the U.S., you know, it's U.S. related stuff, U.S. focused stuff. But William White's book, The Organization Man, which was actually one about, partly about where I was growing up, Park Forest, Suburb Chicago, but also C. Wright Mills and others. Yes. I thought, God, sociology is so cool. Yeah. For the reasons you just said, I really, really liked it. So that's interesting. So, okay, so you said you remember him or something like that. What was it about that particular professor? Was there something in particular, aside from him doggedly telling you you need to major in comms communication?
His teaching style was really relaxed, and the culture that he built in the classroom was very much like student-led, very relaxed, and he was really focused on the culture because we did speeches in that class, like three speeches, your standard communication course. And public speaking is really scary.
Yes. For
just about everybody.
Yes, and absolutely.
So I really appreciated how he helped us find our voice in class so that we can find it when we're presenting.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And I assume we'll talk more about your own teaching, but I'm sure that's influencing your own. It's amazing how, for good and ill, sometimes both, but how influential teachers are on us as teachers. It's really something. I find myself, there are moments literally when I'm saying to the students, I mean, I'm lecturing, let's say, or running into trying to run a discussion section, and realize I'm channeling, you know, so-and-so from high school or, you know, or someone from one of my PhD profs. It's very strange and cool. I mean, strange in kind of a good way for me. That's neat. That's a neat memory. So, but from there, when did you decide to go on for an MA at Fresno in communication?
Yeah. So I graduated in 2008, when the economy
crashed. Yes. Seared into our brain. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I was like, you know what, maybe the real world, let's delay that for a while. I knew I wanted to do graduate school for a long time. Like I knew that even before I had even entered college, but I wasn't sure what I wanted to do for a long time. I wanted to do law. But then I was, you know, really questioning that, and I wanted to stay locally in my hometown. And so I was looking at the programs that Fresno State offered, and communication was the one that was, you know, I was most familiar with. I was pretty good at it. And when I talked to faculty members about like the master's degree in communication, I was really encouraged to do so.
You were really, oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
That was how I came about to it. It was, I see it as being divinely like led to this path. It wasn't something that I necessarily, you know, charted out for myself, but I couldn't have been happier with it. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's totally music to my ears, by the way, because I don't know if we have regular listeners, I hope, for the podcast, they know it's the theme of the podcast. I mean, so many students, right, think they have to have it all sorted out. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's not the students, it's the adults who think they should have it all. And no. And so I love these stories where, which wasn't true of me. I think I pretty much knew I wanted to be. I loved my history teachers in high school. So, but I love these stories where there's not necessarily a straight path or, you know, what if? I mean, what if instead of a professor at Fresno when you're an undergraduate encouraging you to minor and major in comp studies, maybe it was something else. I don't know. Who knows what might have happened. But that's just a neat story. You do not have students, prospective students and current students. You don't have to have everything sorted out, right? You just don't. So what was your MA work like? What were you focusing on a particular area in communication?
Yes. So one of the things that I grew to appreciate about communication is how versatile and sort of foundational to life it is. And my interest has always been in, you know, politics, political culture. And at the time, I was really focused on international political culture. And so I was able to pursue that interest through my communication degree.
That's cool.
And my project at the time was on veiling discourse, so the discourse about hijab in France.
Oh, no kidding. Oh, that's, I remember that. Wow, that was a bit, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And sort of how, you know, veiling serves as or represents a threat to Frenchness and French identity. Right. And that's why it's... The reaction to it is sometimes a little bit more intense in France than
was it? I'm trying to remember. Was it in fact outlawed at some point in France?
In public schools and in public institutions, women were banned from veiling.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that still true? Do you know? I don't know.
I can't say for sure. I haven't kept up with it, but at the time, yeah.
Yeah. So were you looking at the rhetoric around this issue? Mm-hmm. Is that the idea?
Yeah, the rhetoric in public discourse. So what were people publishing? What were the arguments justifying this ban, given that this is like a secular nation and, you know, an inviting nation and a nation that has a sizable immigrant population? Right. So what were the justifications there?
Yeah. What'd you find out? Is it simply fear? I mean, I don't know what you said, fear of losing French identity or something.
Yeah. That, you know, religious symbols are antithetical to like this French identity, that the number one sort of identity is Frenchness and then other things follow. Yeah.
Well, I guess that goes back to the French Revolution, right? I mean, the anti-clericalism. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so cool. And gosh, I wish I had, sometimes I think I would have loved what you do. I know I would have loved that. I don't know about the speaking part, but the analysis of speeches, and I just love doing that. That's one of my favorite things as a historian, to take some text or speech and just dig into it. And you know, anyway, it sounds interesting. And of course, personal too, right? I mean, you know, somewhat personal. So you go on to what from there to the PhD program at Maryland. I know Maryland for its, you know, great history department. What was it about the comp studies department that drew you there?
It's a, you know, a top 10 rhetoric program in America.
That's a good reason.
it's a really, really prestigious program in rhetoric. And what's interesting about comp studies is that our discipline did not grow in the Ivies. Like, there isn't a comm program in any of the Ivy Leagues except for Cornell, and it's part of their agriculture school.
Oh, really? Wow.
And so the tradition of like public speaking and of like communication and communication studies really cultivated in public land grant universities.
That's interesting. I did not know the history of that. That's interesting. Yeah. I guess there would be, I mean, the Ivies, they would have debate, right? But not.
There'd be debate, but the like culture of like communication and a rhetorical focus, like that's taught elsewhere. Taught, you know, in like religious studies and theology and lots, and obviously debate, but like as a discipline, it thrived in the public university.
That's interesting. Is that still true of the Ivies? Do you know? I mean,
I believe so. Last time I checked, I believe that not yet. They don't have comm.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I did not know that. So, that's a good reason to go there. Did you have in mind a mentor already, or did you just show up and hi, here I am?
Well, I mean, the other reason why I chose University of Maryland is its proximity to Washington, D.C. and the National Archives and Library of Congress. And so, you know, studying political rhetoric and political culture there was really, really helpful. I also wanted to work with Dr. Sahar Khamis, who's there. She's a media studies professor, and she's also of Egyptian descent, and she does amazing work on like Arab Spring and Arab activism. And so, so at the time, this was like in 2014. This was just a few years after the Arab Spring. And so that was like on my mind. And I had originally thought I was going to do some, like, that's what my focus would be on. And for a while it was, I was focused on the Egyptian Revolution. But my sort of interests changed like after my comprehensive exams towards more U.S. focused discourse.
Yeah. And I want to come back. I want to certainly talk to you, ask you about your PhD topic, your research. But, you know, it occurs to me listening to you, what was that? Can you remember how you felt as you're reading about or hearing about? I suppose you saw family, right, back in Egypt during the Arab Spring. I mean, were you like exhilarated or hopeful? Or I'm just curious.
Oh, yeah, it was, 2011. I was really, really hopeful. And I think that that's a sentiment that many people shared. Being really optimistic. And it wasn't just happening in Egypt. It was starting in Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, all of these movements were happening. And, you know, by 2014, there was like less optimism about it and more, you could see how complicated change really was because of these like embedded, deeply, deeply rooted structures.
Yes.
Like militaries and leadership. And so,
That's a profound, I think a profoundly important point. It relates to what's happening, I think in Iran right now too. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, I mean, you can have these mass protests and incredible mm-hmm. actions, but if there's military power against you, you're getting shot, jailed. I mean, boy, I mean, that's that's a lot to challenge, right? Just by showing up in the streets. And so I can relate. I mean, I can only relate, you know, thinking about Iran. And I've been hopeful there, but boy, I mean, we'll see. And it could take a long time too, right? Yeah. Aside from all the violence that you might meet with. I suppose your parents were riveted by it as well, I'm imagining.
Absolutely, yeah. They were really, really hopeful. I think a lot of people were. And, you know, we're still hopeful for positive changes, but the stark reality on the ground is a little bit different.
That's, that's the phrase, the stark reality on the ground, exactly. And you do have family back there, right? Is it or not? I mean, you have uncles and aunts or family you're close to in Egypt?
Absolutely, yeah. A large, happy family there. Yeah.
So you have that, still that connection as well. Yeah, I have no idea who's in Greece. I mean, I probably have some distant, I hope, but I hope so I can one day find them and they contribute to good Greek food. I don't know. But I know no immediate family or anything, like no uncles or aunts. But you change gears. You can correct me, but the topic I have in front of me for your dissertation, maybe it's the title of your dissertation, is Purity, Preservation, and Protection, Fundamentalist Arguments in American Discourse. Yeah. And honest to God, once I see that title, first of all, I like the alliteration in the first, but I'm in. I want to know more. Mm-hmm. So, and we were kind of joking, or I was joking at least, before we started recording. Sometimes I ask people about their dissertation work, and it's the last thing they want to talk about, partly because it was a while ago. But in your case, it's still pretty recent, and it sounds like you're still interested in it. But tell us a little bit about, how you came to that topic. You said something about the... was it the qualifying exams or something? Maybe put you on the report. But how you came to the topic and what that topic, where that topic took you?
Yeah, so I had originally wanted to study revolution discourse in Egypt. Okay. It just, at the time, it just wasn't safe to go to Egypt and do archival work and interview people. And so just practically speaking, I needed to change my topic. So at the time I was also doing, deliberation and dialogue work.
Right. I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was facilitating intergroup dialogues on religious identity. And, I started to notice some of the obstacles that come to fruitful and productive and helpful dialogue. And, in the literature, we know that some of the biggest challenges to good deliberation. Oh, and let me give a definition of deliberation.
Okay. Yeah, sure. That helpful.
Yeah. Helpful. So deliberation is, discussions amongst each other with the purpose of making a decision. Okay. So, and sometimes that decision can be really abstract. How do we want, our campus to look like? And sometimes that decision is really, really, really concrete. What are we going to eat for lunch? So, but those discussions towards a shared goal are deliberative.
That makes sense. It's not just talking, deliberating for the sake of deliberating. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Okay. And so, it's an important skill, and, obstacles come. There are obstacles to it happening well. And usually those obstacles are apathy, that people don't want to or aren't invested in talking and expending the energy and the time in discussing an issue. And sometimes the obstacle is that people want consensus too quickly and aren't willing to really dig deep into the issue and talk about the differences and talk about where they disagree and how to overcome those disagreements. But the obstacle that I was interested in was the folks that are willing to be disagreeable, the people that are willing to be against the grain, and how that disrupts that discussion. So I witnessed this in my courses, and it oftentimes, the disruptors were oftentimes people who strongly identified with their religion. And were demonstrating, what we call a fundamentalist argumentation. So I was what do we know about this fundamentalism and communication? And
just to pause here, when you say, I wanted to ask you about that fundamentalist, is that, do you mean that word in the title, as you just use it in the religious sense, or is it something else?
That's a good question, because it's a hotly debated thing, that definition in and of itself. Who do we consider fundamentalist?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And so for a while, in the 80s and the 90s, that term was really widely applied to anyone who strongly identified with their beliefs, but not just identified with their beliefs, but also worked politically in service of those beliefs. So the true believers. So fundamentalists were the true believers who believe unironically in their faith, and sincerely with their faith, or they were the religious extremists, that people who like used violence and justified it through religion. And then there have been like since revisions of like, well, this term is like not super useful and, you know, it does more harm than good and it doesn't describe what we think it describes. So we shouldn't use it. So that was like kind of confusing for me while I was doing this research. Mm-hmm. But what I landed on was like, who do we know for sure is like the who do we know for sure are fundamentalists? And those are the first fundamentalists. And they came from America. Sure. And they called themselves like this was a self-proclaimed identity, self-proclaimed label. The term fundamentalist now is oftentimes used to denigrate others. And
yes,
like, oh, my goodness, you're a fundamentalist. Like,
yes,
exactly. We don't have to talk to you anymore. Like, there's no shared reference between us. And that's what I was seeing in my dialogues, is that there were these two conversations happening and they were parallel and rarely intersecting. Okay. And the first conversation was between, you know, the other students. And then there was one conversation between the person who like used this religious discourse and the facilitators. Okay. And rarely did those two conversations intersect. And so I wanted to like understand this, like what is going on here and why is there anything that we can do to facilitate better conversations in such like intractable arguments?
So did your research involve, almost sounds like it did, but let me know, did it involve kind of you looking at people engaging in this dialogue? I mean, you're not just reading stuff, it sounds like. You're actually watching people engage or trying to engage in deliberation?
Well, the challenge became that, like, we don't have clear parameters for what is fundamentalist argumentation. Like, okay. Our field doesn't know that yet. Okay. And so my project was... it did two things. The first thing that my project did was trace the history of fundamentalist discourse in America. And through that tracing, identify some core like features and characteristics that like we could take into a situation, be like, you know what, somebody is engaging in fundamentalist argumentation.
Okay. Right. So you'd be able to identify.
This is like a pre-step. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And yeah. So, and then, are you doing observations as part of your research? I mean,
that would be like the next step. Yeah.
Next
right
step.
Now,
okay.
I was just studying, foundational texts of
Got
different,
okay.
Reactionary movements. Yeah.
Got it. Okay. And mm-hmm. so the purity, preservation and protection those are, I take it, markers of fundamentalist arguments or.
Yeah, they are important themes. So maybe I should talk about like the first fundamentalists, the
sure.
people who like invented this term.
Sure.
So fundamentalism began, and this is like something that most scholars would agree with, is the people that we know for sure are fundamentalists are a group of evangelical theologians who began in the early 20th century, and they were... and it's a theological movement that began in response to the modernist controversies of the 19th century.
Okay. Yep.
And so those controversies for the uninitiated were the modernist debates were basically, you know, theologians. It was among the intellectual class of, you know, Christian theologians. And they were questioning, you know, biblical inerrancy and the virgin birth of Christ. And, you know, these things that are really foundational to Christianity and Christian
yes.
thought.
Right.
And so in reaction to those, to modernism, basically, a group of people, many of whom were, you know, not theologians, labeled themselves as fundamentalists, as the people who were defending the fundamentals of faith.
Okay. They used the term, and it wasn't a pejorative term. It wasn't a term thrown at them. Yeah. It's their term. Yeah. That's important to know.
Their term. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it was a defensive posture of like something really important to us is being attacked and threatened, and we're here to defend it. And so there's a big series of publications that were published between 1910 and 1915. They're called The Fundamentals, A Testimony to the Truth. There was a series of 12 volumes, and they were distributed across the English-speaking world.
Wow.
And I studied those. That was like the first step. I studied those volumes to look at like, okay, what's the argument being made here? Can we figure a genre, an argument that we can identify as a fundamentalist argument? And the argument ended up being really, really simple and familiar to many of us. That argument is our identity as Christians is derived and needs to the idea of biblical inerrancy and other tenets, like core tenets in Christianity, in order to exist.
Okay.
So in other words, like if these things are not true,
right.
If we don't believe in these things, like Christianity as it exists doesn't work anymore.
This is what we now call an existential threat.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's really what it is that fundamentalist discourse. And that's the core argument that I make in my project is that fundamentalist argumentation happens in response to an existential threat.
Okay.
And it isn't just, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to add that it's not just any existential threat. It's a threat to your core identity, the fundamentals of identity. Like without this thing, your group identity no longer exists. And so for these first fundamentalists, it was the Bible. In the other cases that I study in my project, it was whiteness.
Right. This is that's what I was going to
say. Or nature, something even external. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, listening to you, this is also very helpful to me because I teach, a course on post-war U.S. and recent U.S. anyway, in 1968. But yeah, I wanted to ask him. So this is, clearly this helps us, right, understand whether you want to call it Trumpism or, white, whatever. But people who feel that their identity, their America is on the line. Because these words, in the dissertation title, purity, preservation, protection, that sounds like so much of what we hear now in our political discourse. So were you consciously, for the dissertation, were you bringing it up to the present or not? Are you just sort of focusing on those first fundamentalists?
Yeah, so I sort of track it as a rhetorical tradition
okay.
in American political discourse. And we see that tradition show up in a lot of our like most hotly debated topics. So, for example, the current controversy about history and what we teach in our elementary schools.
Yes. Right.
Where we cultivate, civic identity and American identity. I think what sort of sets parents off is this idea that my child's Americanness isn't going to be pure and good anymore.
Yes. The whole thing about, I'm using a textbook by the great U.S. historian Eric Foner, using that in the U.S. first half.
I cited him a lot.
Oh, okay. So he knows. Yeah. And one of the themes of the textbook, it's aimed at undergraduates, is who's an American, right? Mm-hmm. Who gets to count as that? And man, the battles are fierce. And they're not entirely new either, as we know. Boy, this sounds like a really good dissertation. Turn it into a book. Is that the plan?
Hopefully, inshallah, yeah.
Good. Okay, good. Yeah, no, it sounds fantastic with lots of implications for political science. And now my head is spinning, imagining you team teaching with someone in the poli sci, or maybe me. I would love to. Lots of people know I want to team teach with after talking to them on the podcast. Yeah, but this business of purity, preservation, protection. Wow.
Yeah. And the purity is important because there's this underlying, like what I noticed was how much time was spent arguing for why we should preserve the purity of what I call the authoritative source. Okay. So whatever the authoritative source is, like that upon which our identity is based, that has to stay pure. So like whether it's a spiritual text or our understanding of a scripture that needs to stay pure, or whether it is, you know, whiteness, or whether it's even nature. Like the third case that I studied was Barry Commoner's argument for environmentalism.
Oh my gosh. And I saw him when I was an undergraduate.
Wonderful. Yeah. And I argue that, you know, this discourse, we oftentimes associate it with like right wing argumentation, but it exists also on, you know, more progressive and even beneficial and useful and helpful arguments as well.
Yeah, that's also an incredibly important point. Oh my gosh. I want to stop the podcast and go read your dissertation, but I can't do that.
I don't know about that. It needs a lot of edits.
All right. Well, I know it sure as heck sounds interesting and very important and timely. And, you know, and everything you're saying about the word fundamentalist, too. I mean, I remember I had the same thing with the word evangelical. So I think I've said this before in the podcast. I did not know much. I think I was baptized in the Greek Orthodox Church, and then, but mostly, you know, my dad was joined an Episcopal congregation in the suburbs of Chicago. Anyway, the word evangelical for me was, oh my God, run the other way. These are people who want to roll back, you know, in my head, right? More complicated. But so when I was interviewing for Gustavus and, you know, Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, that scared me. I really did. I had to do some talking and digging, including with people on campus during my interview who were really great and educating me, really, you know, because I thought, oh my God, this is, I don't know if I want to be at an evangelical, you know, to me, it was meant like a Bible, like a Falwell, Liberty University or something like that, you know, which it is not. It sounds like fantastic work. So you're, congrats on finishing. Was your defense? I was trying to remember, when was your defense? Was it last spring
Last spring. And it was also done on Zoom.
Oh, wow. No kidding. Yeah. The defense was done on Zoom. Wow. Well, congratulations, doctor. Yeah, it's awesome. Are you the first PhD in your family?
In not my extended family. I have uncles that have PhDs. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, they don't count. We'll focus on the extended family. So that's
and
great.
And uncles. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. Really cool. So, I mean, you really do have, you have this interest in politics and political discourse and political engagement. And I didn't know you were involved in the voter engagement efforts on the Gustavus campus. And I mean, such efforts are going on across campuses. And of course, they're contested, right? I mean, there are efforts to make sure young people don't vote in the numbers they do, efforts by some. But tell us a little bit about those engagement efforts here at Gustavus, what they're about. As we approach, by the way, I should note we're recording on Friday, October 28th, and the election is imminent, shall we say.
Yes. The efforts that we've been doing is basically voter registration, just encouraging students and making voter registration as easy and as accessible and as well informed as possible. And so we've been focusing on, you know, my role as a faculty member has focused my attention towards faculty and how to discuss and encourage voting in the classroom, while at the same time maintaining, you know, a nonpartisan status in the classroom. So we've been, you know, running workshops and, you know, distributing materials to faculty to get the information out.
Well, I'm grateful to you. And is it Marion Broida as well? And I don't know who else is, other people too involved.
Lots of folks. Amy Pearson and Megan Rubel. They've all been really instrumental in the voter engagement.
That's great. So education, student affairs, and I just think it's obviously super important. And it's funny. I mean, I tell my students, one of the stories I share with them is when I first voted in 1972 and just how I was against the war in Vietnam and I was so excited. I thought George McGovern walked on water. Plus, he had a PhD in history and had gone to graduate school with my then mentor and blah, blah, blah. You know, only to have a rather rude awakening as he goes down into massive defeat in 72. My faith in voting was shaken, but it's come back. So yeah, I'm proud of our students. I'm proud of the efforts on this campus and others. I think it's great. I think maybe even, are we doing a revised schedule even? Is that happening?
We are, yeah. A modified schedule on November 8th.
Modifies the word I'm looking for. Thank you. Yeah, that's exciting because I don't think I could be wrong. I think that's new, or at least newer. I'm not sure we've done that in the past. So that's all exciting. We'll see what happens. So you're doing that. The other thing I just think that's interesting. You were involved, and maybe are here as well. You can share that if you'd like. But was it at Maryland where you're involved in these? Efforts around anti-racism, you even alluded to it earlier, these you know, sitting down with people to get them to talk, et cetera, et cetera. I just wonder, what has it been like for you as a Muslim American woman on this campus? I mean, this is a quote unquote Christian, it's not a church college. It's what do we call church related? I remember when I came here, someone said to me, some undergraduate said, I was darker, I guess. I had a lot of beard and hair, but you're so dark. Where do you come from? And Chicago and I was like, wait, but what is that? I mean, is it weird? Coming from, well, even Baltimore, right? Or Maryland, where College Park, where you were, is different. What's it been like?
It was, different. I came from an institution. So University of Maryland has Muslim students everywhere. To the point where I don't even know all the Muslim students. At Fresno State, I knew all the Muslim students because we were very visible. And so I went to Maryland. It's a much bigger school. I didn't know everybody, but I also didn't feel like super remarkable or out of place. This is just another person. Here, I felt like I stood out a little bit more. I veil, I wear hijab, I'm visibly Muslim.
Yes.
It's been a wonderful experience. I couldn't have asked for a better place to be. I also feel like me coming here was divinely led. I'm really grateful. The students have been wonderful. My colleagues have been wonderful. Everybody has been welcoming and accommodating and understanding. I couldn't have asked for a better place to be.
That's good to know. Great to know. And I have to say too, I mean, I don't go to church. I don't know if I'm an agnostic, an atheist. I'm not sure what I am, I've always felt comfortable here and never felt, I mean, sometimes I go to chapel or I've even spoken in chapel, but it's not required. But growing up, you were going to a mosque, right? Mm-hmm. And you're still doing that, I'm assuming.
I try to attend, Friday prayers.
Is that here or in Mankato nearby, or where do you go?
Mankato. It's closer to my house. Although there is a small masjid here in St. Peter. Lovely.
When you were, around the time of, I'm trying to think how you were, 9/11 and its aftermath, were you experiencing heightened, were you sort of aware or on guard about, not just nativism and racism, but even physical violence? Was that something that you had to worry about or think about?
Yes, unfortunately, like many folks who experienced 9/11, I remember it very vividly and remember the time right after. I was on independent study, so I was homeschooled for high school. So I didn't go to school. I was on an independent study program. But I still lived my life. We went out and, went shopping and went to the parks and everything like that. And then after 9/11, my parents decided nobody's going out. We're not going to go out and it was an extended amount of time. I want to say a little less than a month. It was maybe a month of just, we're going to hunker down and we don't know what's going on. And that was an interesting experience. I think my parents' concern about our safety really heightened that concern with me too.
Sure.
The time, a lot of hate incidents that happened.
Right. No, it was not good. I mean, and even still, I just remembered my, was in Rochester, Minnesota with my cousin's then husband. He's since unfortunately passed away. Mm-hmm. And he had a really cool beret that he was wearing. And it may have been during the Kerry campaign, John Kerry campaign, mm-hmm. you know, and some guys driving by, you know, just yelling and screaming, you know, obscenities about the beret, you know, it's un-American beret, a French, you know, bastard or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this guy's a vet, you know, he was in Vietnam and there he is, you know, having to put up with this minor compared to what a lot of Muslim Americans have had to put up
and
with.
And a lot of sick Americans as well have to endure a lot of.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. We should not forget. Thank you. That's exactly right. Yeah. It's just that part of our country's history is unfortunately alive and well. But I'm glad to hear that about Gustavus. That's reassuring. And mm-hmm. I think, I mean, Mankato is, well, it seems more diverse than St. Peter. I mean, it's bigger for one thing, mm-hmm. with more international students. So have you had a chance to think much about or reflect on Gustavus students compared to where you've been elsewhere? I'm just, again, curious or thoughts about teaching here mm-hmm. compared to teaching. Because you really haven't taught at a kind of classic liberal arts college like this, or am I wrong?
You are correct. This is my first experience.
And I had not either, by the way. So, mm-hmm. yeah. Go ahead.
I didn't attend a liberal arts college.
Nor did I.
Yeah. Yeah. And so teaching in a liberal arts, at a liberal arts institution has been really, really refreshing and mm-hmm. really lovely. I appreciate the emphasis on like writing and speaking and thinking. Which at the end of the day, like when people ask me what I teach, that's what I tell them I do.
That's a great answer.
Thinking, writing, and speaking.
Beautiful answer. That's what we all do. That's exactly right. Yeah. I'm going to be quoting you. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I feel like, I mean, historically, rhetoric, like the oldest branch of communication studies, is part of the classical liberal education.
You went to Harvard or Yale, whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, exactly. Rhetoric. Yeah, I mean, in my head, what's different, I guess, in my head, I thought there'd be a lot more leisure. I thought we'd have a lot more time, you know, but no, we're incredibly busy. And I know it's not just here. But still, there's sometimes the busyness gets to be a bit overwhelming when it interferes with teaching. Mm. But I do like that. And I like the ability to be creative intellectually. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have to specialize, right? I can do a podcast, mm-hmm. you know, with the college's approval and help. And so, and you know, maybe I wish sometimes there were more opportunities for team teaching. Mm. You know, on an ever-growing list of people I would love to team teach with at some point. But yeah, I do like being, this is where I want to be. I want to be at a liberal arts college. I don't want to be at a big university where I have to publish or perish and specialize.
In my PhD program, I was like, I'm not built for this. I like teaching. I want to teach. Yeah.
Same here. Yeah. No, that's the same. My wife, Kate, went to Bard College. So she had that liberal arts experience, but I did not. But I really like it, really enjoy it. So as we're winding down here with the last few minutes, a couple of one question is to ask you about, you kind of touched on this earlier, you know, you said communicate, you're right, communication is foundational, but make the case for your discipline at a liberal arts college. And your discipline in general. Why should we care? Why should we study communication?
That's a great question. I feel like communication sometimes gets a bad reputation as being like an easy major. Yeah. But I see it as being possibly the most, it equips people really well to live in a world where we're connected more than ever. And, you know, the conditions of our workplaces, of our democracy, of our society are constantly changing.
Yeah.
And I think communication studies equips students with, one, the critical thinking skills to be able to like adapt to the circumstances, respond to like moments that need responding to. And it's really practical. They learn how to read, write, and think.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is needed everywhere.
Right. And Someone I was just talking, I guess it was a city, a former city council person. She's been redistricted out of but anyway, city council person in Minneapolis who said, communication, mm-hmm. writing and, you know, and speaking, mm-hmm. that's it. And she was kind of kidding, you know, no one wants to debate with me. They know I'm good, you know, mm-hmm. but yeah, I mean, it's foundational. It's so important. And, I love oratory. I mean, I don't mm-hmm. study it the way you might, but I just I love great. I love reading it. I love reading about people like Frederick Douglass mm-hmm. in this country, and even although Lincoln's voice probably would have driven yeah. me nuts. But I just find that extremely interesting. And God, I mean, there's no way to understand what's been happening in this country the last, you know, whatever you want to say, 4 years, 8 years, whatever, or more, without understanding public discourse, mm-hmm. right? Political discourse. So super important. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to add one thing about the way we teach communication here at Gustavus is mm-hmm. The oratory is important, and our students learn, you know, the canon of speeches that are sure. important in public discourse, right. but they also learn how to do dialogue and deliberation.
Yes.
And the yes. deliberative, we have a whole co-curricular program, which I happen to co-direct right now.
Oh, congrats. Oh, that's great.
Thank you. Oh, but the emphasis of teaching students how to have these deliberations, how to talk yes. to each other in order yes. to make decisions.
Right.
And how this fits with like democracy,
yeah.
and inclusion and diversity and, you know, all the important things that we want for our world. Right. There's an emphasis on that here.
Yeah. And thank you for mentioning that. One of the first people I podcast with way, I don't know, 130 episodes ago, was your colleague, Pam Connors.
Mm-hmm. She's one of the founders.
Yeah. And it's great. It's fantastic. Those days, the podcasts were very short, so we didn't, I hope she was able to mention it. I think we touched on it. But anyway, super important. I go back and forth. I don't know where you are. Sometimes I'm optimistic about, dialogue with someone who's, I don't know, to me, they're not in a fact-based world. I know mm-hmm. that's the greatest challenge for me. Or imagining I'm, I don't know, a Muslim American or an Afro, whatever, and they don't want me in the country. I'm not mm-hmm. sure I want to sit down and try to dialogue with them. But on the other hand, if we don't have some kind of dialogue and deliberation, I don't know what happens to our mm-hmm. country. It's worrisome. To say it's scary, it's more than worrisome. And that's playing out right in our politics right now in Congress. And anyway, that's another podcast. But thank you. Yeah, you've got a great department, great colleagues. Welcome to Gustavus.
Thank you.
And you're welcome. And really quickly, I've got to ask you about this. So I saw you've got some interesting hobbies, including, I think, kittens. But one of the things I saw mentioned was, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's, you said historical dramas. Is that?
Yes.
Is that it? Yeah. So say a little bit about that.
I love a good historical TV show. But emphasis on like heavy on the drama, light on the history, although I like the history too. I had written that description while we were in lockdown during the pandemic. And I had watched a bunch of, I watched the show, The Medicis.
Oh yeah.
But yeah. I learned a bunch, like as I was watching it. And again, that show is like really heavy on the drama, light on the history.
Right.
I looked up the Medici family and, you know, all of the, you know, how foundational they were and important they were to the yep. bank, the world banking system.
Hugely. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
So I like shows that sort of inspire me to go nerd out in some history.
Are you a Hamilton musical fan? It's okay if you're not.
I have been waiting to finish my dissertation and I have refused to like watch anything, listen to anything until I have like the full on experience, but I'm waiting for that.
Yeah.
I'm love it.
Yeah. I do love it. It has its issues, but I still love it. That jumped out at me cause I love teaching about, you know, history and film and, you know, history and drama. Yeah. It's cool. I know there are all kinds of issues, right. And as one historian, I think it was Eric Fone. I heard him say at a conference, historians are killjoys. You know, we want to say the movie's horrible. This is wrong. This is inaccurate. But to the extent that they can get people thinking more and going and looking up the Medicis mm-hmm. or whatever, Googling, you know, hallelujah. I'm off of that. So, well, this has been really fun and to be continued, no doubt. Welcome to Gustavus. It's really been great. I've really enjoyed. Yeah, you're welcome. Really enjoyed getting to know more about you and your work, and have a good weekend.
Thank you, too. And thank you for always being so welcoming and inviting me to this podcast.
My pleasure. Yeah. I mean, this is one of the greatest things about being a professor, right? We get to meet some really interesting people who come from all different places. That is, for me, it's, and students, too. But yeah, that's a good thing. So take good care. See you around the proverbial water cooler.
Sounds good. Take care and have a good weekend.
You, too. Thanks, Hagar. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Learning for Life at Gustavus is produced by J.J. Aiken and Matthew Dobosensky of the Gustavus Office of Marketing, Gustavus graduate Will Clark, class of 20, who also provides technical expertise to the podcast, and me. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus Adolphus College.